fact, and anybody in the valley could have told you as much. He was weather-worn inside and out, as taut and rugged as the horses he ran wild on the mountain. Dad's mother worked for the Farm Bureau in town. As an adult, Dad would develop fierce opinions about women working, radical even for our rural Mormon community. "A woman's place is in the home," he would say every time he saw a married woman working in town. Now I'm older, I sometimes wonder if Dad's fervor had more to do with his own mother than with doctrine. I wonder if he just wished that she had been home, so he wouldn't have been left for all those long hours with Grandpa's temper. Running the farm consumed Dad's childhood. I doubt he expected to go to college. Still, the way Mother tells it, back then Dad was bursting with energy, laughter, and panache. He drove a baby blue Volkswagen Beetle, wore outlandish suits cut from colorful fabrics, and showcased a thick, fashionable mustache. They met in town. Faye was waitressing at the bowling alley one Friday night when Jean wandered in with a pack of his friends. She'd never seen him before, so she knew immediately that he wasn't from town and must have come from the mountains surrounding the valley. Farm life had made Jean different from other young men. He was serious for his age, more physically impressive, and independent-minded. There's a sense of sovereignty that comes from life on a mountain, a perception of privacy and isolation, even of dominion. In that vast space, you can sail unaccompanied for hours, afloat on pine and brush and rock. It's a tranquility born of sheer immensity. It calms with its very magnitude, which renders the merely human of no consequence. Jean was formed by this alpine hypnosis, this hushing of human drama. In the valley, Faye tried to stop her ears against the constant gossip of a small town whose opinions pushed in through the windows and crept under the doors. Mother often described herself as a pleaser. She said she couldn't stop herself from speculating what people wanted her to be and from contorting herself compulsively, unwillingly, into whatever it was. Living in her respectable house in the center of town, crowded by four other houses, each so near anyone could peer through the windows and whisper a judgment, Faye felt trapped. I've often imagined the moment when Jean took Faye to the top of Buck's Peak and she was, for the first time, unable to see the faces or hear the voices of the people in the town below. They were far away, dwarfed by the mountain, hushed by the wind. They were engaged soon after. Mother used to tell a story from the time before she was married. She had been close to her brother, Lynn, so she took him to meet the man she hoped would be her husband. It was summer, dusk, and Dad's cousins were roughhousing the way they did after a harvest. Lynn arrived and, seeing a room of bow-legged ruffians shouting at each other, fists clenched, swiping at the air, thought he was witnessing a brawl straight out of a John Wayne film. He wanted to call the police. "I told him to listen," Mother would say, tears in her eyes from laughing. She always told this story the same way, and it was such a favorite that if she departed in any way from the usual script, we'd tell it for her. "I told him to pay attention to the actual words they were shouting. Everyone sounded mad as hornets, but really they were having a lovely conversation. You had to listen to what they were saying, not how they were saying it. I told him, that's just how Westovers talk." By the time she'd finished, we were usually on the floor. We'd cackle until our ribs hurt, imagining our prim, professorial uncle meeting Dad's unruly crew. Lynn found the scene so distasteful, he never went back, and in my whole life, I never saw him on the mountain. Served him right, we thought, for his meddling, for trying to draw Mother back into that world of gabardine dresses and cream shoes. We understood that the dissolution of Mother's family was the inauguration of ours. The two could not exist together. Only one could have her. Mother never told us that her family had opposed the engagement, but we knew. There were traces the decades hadn't erased. My father seldom set foot in Grandma over in town's house, and when he did, he was sullen and stared at the door. As a child, I scarcely knew my aunts, uncles, or cousins on my mother's side. We rarely visited them. I didn't even know where most of them lived, and it was even rarer for them to visit the mountain. The exception was my Aunt Angie, my mother's youngest sister, who lived in town and insisted on seeing my mother. What I know about the engagement has come to me in bits and pieces, mostly from the stories Mother told. I know she had the ring before Dad served a mission, which was expected of all faithful Mormon men, and spent 2 years proselytizing in Florida. Lynn took advantage of this absence to introduce his sister to every marriageable man he could find this side of the Rockies, but none could make her forget the stern farm boy who ruled over his own mountain. Jean returned from Florida, and they were married. LaRue sewed the wedding dress. I've only seen a single photograph from the wedding. It's of my parents posing in front of a gossamer curtain of pale ivory. Mother is wearing a traditional dress of beaded silk and Venetian lace with a neckline that sits above her collarbone. An embroidered veil covers her head. My father wears a cream suit with wide black lapels. They are both intoxicated with happiness. Mother with a relaxed smile, Dad with a grin so large it pokes out from under the corners of his mustache. It is difficult for me to believe that the untroubled young man in that photograph is my father. Fearful and anxious, he comes into focus for me as a weary, middle-aged man stockpiling food and ammunition. I don't know when the man in that photograph became the man I know as my father. Perhaps there was no single moment. Dad married when he was 21, had his first son, my brother Tony, at 22. When he was 24, Dad asked Mother if they could hire an herbalist to midwife my brother Sean. She agreed. Was that the first hint? Or was it just Jean being Jean, eccentric and unconventional, trying to shock his disapproving in-laws? After all, when Tyler was born 20 months later, the birth took place in a hospital. When Dad was 27, Luke was born, at home, delivered by a midwife. Dad decided not to file for a birth certificate, a decision he repeated with Audrey, Richard, and me. A few years later, around the time he turned 30, Dad pulled my brothers out of school. I don't remember it, because it was before I was born, but I wonder if perhaps that was a turning point. In the 4 years that followed, Dad got rid of the telephone and chose not to renew his license to drive. He stopped registering and insuring the family car. Then he began to hoard food. This last part sounds like my father, but it is not the father my older brothers remember. Dad had just turned 40 when the feds laid siege to the Weavers, an event that confirmed his worst fears. After that, he was at war, even if the war was only in his head. Perhaps that is why Tony looks at that photo and sees his father, and I see a stranger. 14 years after the incident with the Weavers, I would sit in a university classroom and listen to a professor of psychology describe something called bipolar disorder. Until that moment, I had never heard of mental illness. I knew people could go crazy. They'd wear dead cats on their heads or fall in love with a turnip. But the notion that a person could be functional, lucid, persuasive, and something could still be wrong had never occurred to me. The professor recited facts in a dull, earthy voice. The average age of onset is 25. There may be no symptoms before then. The irony was that if Dad was bipolar, or had any of a dozen disorders that might explain his behavior, the same paranoia that was a symptom of the illness would prevent its ever being diagnosed and treated. No one would ever know. Grandma over in town died 3 years ago, age 86. I didn't know her well. All those years I was passing in and out of her kitchen, and she never told me what it had been like for her, watching her daughter shut herself away, walled in by phantoms and paranoias. When I picture her now, I conjure a single image, as if my memory is a slide projector and the tray is stuck. She's sitting on a cushioned bench. Her hair pushes out of her head in tight curls, and her lips are pulled into a polite smile, which is welded in place. Her eyes are pleasant, but unoccupied, as if she's observing a staged drama. That smile haunts me. It was constant, the only eternal thing, inscrutable, detached, dispassionate. Now that I'm older, and I've taken the trouble to get to know her, mostly through my aunts and uncles, I know she was none of those things. I attended the memorial. It was open casket, and I found myself searching her face. The embalmers hadn't gotten her lips right. The gracious smile she'd worn like an iron mask had been stripped away. It was the first time I'd seen her without it, and that's when it finally occurred to me that Grandma was the only person who might have understood what was happening to me. How the paranoia and fundamentalism were carving up my life, how they were taking from me the people I cared about, and leaving only degrees and certificates, an air of respectability, in their place. What was happening now had happened before. This was the second severing of mother and daughter. The tape was playing in a loop. Chapter 4 Apache Women. No one saw the car leave the road. My brother Tyler, who was 17, fell asleep at the wheel. It was 6 in the morning, and he'd been driving in silence for most of the night, piloting our station wagon through Arizona, Nevada, and Utah. We were in Cornish, a farming town 20 miles south of Buck's Peak, when the station wagon drifted over the center line into the other lane, then left the highway. The car jumped a ditch, smashed through 2 utility poles of thick cedar, and was finally brought to a stop only when it collided with a row crop tractor. The trip had been Mother's idea. A few months earlier, when crisp leaves had begun slipping to the ground, signaling the end of summer, Dad had been in high spirits. His feet tapped show tunes at breakfast, and during dinner he often pointed at the mountain, his eyes shining, and described where he would lay the pipes to bring water down to the house. Dad promised that when the first snow fell, he'd build the biggest snowball in the state of Idaho. What he'd do, he said, was hike to the mountain base and gather a small, insignificant ball of snow, then roll it down the hillside, watching it triple in size each time it raced over a hillock or down a ravine. By the time it reached the house, which was atop the last hill before the valley, it'd be big as Grandpa's barn, and people on the highway would stare up at it, amazed. We just needed the right snow. Thick, sticky flakes. After every snowfall, we brought handfuls to him and watched him rub the flakes between his fingers. That snow was too fine, this too wet. After Christmas, he said, that's when you get the real snow. But after Christmas, Dad seemed to deflate, to collapse in on himself. He stopped talking about the snowball, then he stopped talking altogether. A darkness gathered in his eyes until it filled them. He walked with his arms limp, shoulders slumping, as if something had hold of him and was dragging him to the earth. By January, Dad couldn't get out of bed. He lay flat on his back, staring blankly at the stucco ceiling with its intricate pattern of ridges and veins. He didn't blink when I brought his dinner plate each night. I'm not sure he knew I was there. That's when Mother announced we were going to Arizona. She said Dad was like a sunflower, he'd die in the snow, and that come February, he needed to be taken away and planted in the sun. So we piled into the station wagon and drove for 12 hours, winding through canyons and speeding over dark freeways until we arrived at the mobile home in the parched Arizona desert where my grandparents were waiting out the winter. We arrived a few hours after sunrise. Dad made it as far as Grandma's porch, where he stayed for the rest of the day, a knitted pillow under his head, a calloused hand on his stomach. He kept that posture for 2 days, eyes open, not saying a word, still as a bush in that dry, windless heat. On the 3rd day, he seemed to come back into himself, to become aware of the goings-on around him, to listen to our mealtime chatter rather than staring unresponsive at the carpet. After dinner that night, Grandma played her phone messages, which were mostly neighbors and friends saying hello. Then a woman's voice came through the speaker to remind Grandma of her doctor's appointment the following day. That message had a dramatic effect on Dad. At first, Dad asked Grandma questions. What was the appointment for? Who was it with? Why would she see a doctor when Mother could give her tinctures? Dad had always believed passionately in Mother's herbs, but that night felt different, like something inside him was shifting, a new creed taking hold. Herbalism, he said, was a spiritual doctrine that separated the wheat from the tares, the faithful from the faithless. Then he used a word I'd never heard before, Illuminati. It sounded exotic, powerful, whatever it was. Grandma, he said, was an unknowing agent of the Illuminati. God couldn't abide faithlessness, Dad said. That's why the most hateful sinners were those who wouldn't make up their minds, who used herbs and medication both, who came to Mother on Wednesday and saw their doctor on Friday. Or, as Dad put it, who worship at the altar of God one day and offer a sacrifice to Satan the next. These people were like the ancient Israelites because they'd been given a true religion but hankered after false idols. Doctors and pills, Dad said, nearly shouting. That's their god, and they whore after it. Mother was staring at her food. At the word whore, she stood, threw Dad an angry look, then walked into her room and slammed the door. Mother didn't always agree with Dad. When Dad wasn't around, I'd heard her say things that he, or at least this new incarnation of him, would have called sacrilege. Things like, herbs are supplements. For something serious, you should go to a doctor. Dad took no notice of Mother's empty chair.
Those doctors aren't trying to save you, he told Grandma. They're trying to kill you.
When I think of that dinner, the scene comes back to me clearly. I'm sitting at the table. Dad is talking, his voice urgent. Grandma sits across from me, chewing her asparagus again and again in her crooked jaw, the way a goat might, sipping from her ice water, giving no indication that she's heard a word Dad has said, except for the occasional vexed glare she throws the clock when it tells her it's still too early for bed.
You're a knowing participant in the plans of Satan, Dad says.
This scene played every day, sometimes several times a day, for the rest of the trip. All followed a similar script. Dad, his fervor kindled, would drone for an hour or more, reciting the same lines over and over, fueled by some internal passion that burned long after the rest of us had been lectured into a cold stupor. Grandma had a memorable way of laughing at the end of these sermons. It was a sort of sigh, a long, drawn-out leaking of breath that finished with her eyes rolling upward in a lazy imitation of exasperation, as if she wanted to throw her hands in the air, but was too tired to complete the gesture. Then she'd smile, not a soothing smile for someone else, but a smile for herself, of baffled amusement, a smile that, to me, always seemed to say, "Ain't nothing funnier than real life, I tell you what." It was a scorching afternoon, so hot you couldn't walk barefoot on the pavement, when Grandma took me and Richard for a drive through the desert, having wrestled us into seatbelts, which we'd never worn before. We drove until the road began to incline, then kept driving as the asphalt turned to dust beneath our tires, and still we kept going, Grandma weaving higher and higher into the bleached hills, coming to a stop only when the dirt road ended and a hiking trail began. Then we walked. Grandma was winded after a few minutes, so she sat on a flat red stone and pointed to a sandstone rock formation in the distance, formed of crumbling spires, each a little ruin, and told us to hike to it. Once there, we were to hunt for nuggets of black rock.
They're called Apache tears, she said.
She reached into her pocket and pulled out a small black stone, dirty and jagged, covered in veins of gray and white like cracked glass. and this is how they look after they've been polished a bit. From her other pocket, she withdrew a second stone, which was inky black and so smooth it felt soft. Richard identified both as obsidian. "These are volcanic rock," he said in his best encyclopedic voice. "But this isn't." He kicked a washed-out stone and waved at the formation. "This is sediment." Richard had a talent for scientific trivia. Usually I ignored his lecturing, but today I was gripped by it, and by this strange, thirsty terrain. We hiked around the formation for an hour, returning to Grandma with our shirt fronts sagging with stones. Grandma was pleased. She could sell them. She put them in the trunk, and as we made our way back to the trailer, she told us the legend of the Apache Tears. According to Grandma, 100 years ago, a tribe of Apaches had fought the U.S. cavalry on those faded rocks. The tribe was outnumbered, the battle lost, the war over. All that was left to do was wait to die. Soon after the battle began, the warriors became trapped on a ledge. Unwilling to suffer a humiliating defeat, cut down one by one as they tried to break through the cavalry, they mounted their horses and charged off the face of the mountain. When the Apache women found their broken bodies on the rocks below, they cried huge, desperate tears, which turned to stone when they touched the earth. Grandma never told us what happened to the women. The Apaches were at war, but had no warriors, so perhaps she thought the ending too bleak to say aloud. The word slaughter came to mind, because slaughter is the word for it, for a battle when one side mounts no defense. It's the word we used on the farm. We slaughtered chickens, we didn't fight them. A slaughter was the likely outcome of the warriors' bravery. They died as heroes, their wives as slaves. As we drove to the trailer, the sun dipping in the sky, its last rays reaching across the highway, I thought about the Apache women. Like the sandstone altar on which they had died, the shape of their lives had been determined years before, before the horses began their gallop, their sorrel bodies arching for that final collision. Long before the warriors' leap, it was decided how the women would live and how they would die. By the warriors, by the women themselves. Decided. Choices, numberless as grains of sand, had layered and compressed, coalescing into sediment, then into rock, until all was set in stone. I had never before left the mountain, and I ached for it, for the sight of the princess etched in pine across the massif. I found myself glancing at the vacant Arizona sky, hoping to see her black form swelling out of the earth, laying claim to her half of the heavens. But she was not there. More than the sight of her, I missed her caresses, the wind she sent through canyons and ravines to sweep through my hair every morning. In Arizona, there was no wind. There was just one heat-stricken hour after another. I spent my days wandering from one side of the trailer to the other, then out the back door, across the patio, over to the hammock, then around to the front porch, where I'd step over Dad's semi-conscious form and back inside again. It was a great relief when, on the sixth day, Grandpa's four-wheeler broke down and Tyler and Luke took it apart to find the trouble. I sat on a large barrel of blue plastic, watching them, wondering when we could go home, when Dad would stop talking about the Illuminati, when Mother would stop leaving the room whenever Dad entered it. That night after dinner, Dad said it was time to go. "Get your stuff," he said. "We're hitting the road in a half hour." It was early evening, which Grandma said was a ridiculous time to begin a 12-hour drive. Mother said we should wait until morning, but Dad wanted to get home so he and the boys could scrap the next morning. "I can't afford to lose any more work days," he said. Mother's eyes darkened with worry, but she said nothing. I awoke when the car hit the first utility pole. I'd been asleep on the floor under my sister's feet, a blanket over my head. I tried to sit up, but the car was shaking, lunging. It felt like it was coming apart, and Audrey fell on top of me. I couldn't see what was happening, but I could feel and hear it. Another loud thud, a lurch, my mother screaming, "Tyler!" from the front seat, and a final violent jolt before everything stopped and silence set in. Several seconds passed in which nothing happened. Then I heard Audrey's voice. She was calling our names one by one. Then she said, "Everyone's here except Tara." I tried to shout, but my face was wedged under the seat, my cheek pressed to the floor. I struggled under Audrey's weight as she shouted my name. Finally, I arched my back and pushed her off, then stuck my head out of the blanket and said, "Here." I looked around. Tyler had twisted his upper body so that he was practically climbing into the back seat, his eyes bulging as he took in every cut, every bruise, every pair of wide eyes. I could see his face, but it didn't look like his face. Blood gushed from his mouth and down his shirt. I closed my eyes, trying to forget the twisted angles of his blood-stained teeth. When I opened them again, it was to check everyone else. Richard was holding his head, a hand over each ear like he was trying to block out a noise. Audrey's nose was strangely hooked, and blood was streaming from it down her arm. Luke was shaking, but I couldn't see any blood. I had a gash on my forearm from where the seat's frame had caught hold of me.
"Everyone all right?"
My father's voice. There was a general mumble.
"There are power lines on the car," Dad said. "Nobody gets out till they've shut them off."
His door opened, and for a moment I thought he'd been electrocuted, but then I saw he'd pitched himself far enough so that his body had never touched the car and the ground at the same time. I remember peering at him through my shattered window as he circled the car, his red cap pushed back so the brim reached upward, licking the air. He looked strangely boyish. He circled the car, then stopped, crouching low, bringing his head level with the passenger seat.
"Are you okay?"
he said. Then he said it again. The third time he said it, his voice quivered. I leaned over the seat to see who he was talking to, and only then realized how serious the accident had been. The front half of the car had been compressed, the engine arched, curving back over itself like a fold in solid rock. There was a glare on the windshield from the morning sun. I saw crisscrossing patterns of fissures and cracks. The sight was familiar. I'd seen hundreds of shattered windshields in the junkyard, each one unique, with its particular spray of gossamer extruding from the point of impact, a chronicle of the collision. The cracks on our windshield told their own story. The epicenter was a small ring with fissures circling outward. The ring was directly in front of the passenger seat.
"You okay?"
Dad pleaded.
"Honey, can you hear me?"
Mother was in the passenger seat. Her body faced away from the window. I couldn't see her face, but there was something terrifying in the way she slumped against her seat.
"Can you hear me?"
Dad said. He repeated this several times. Eventually, in a movement so small it was almost imperceptible, I saw the tip of Mother's ponytail dip as she nodded. Dad stood, looking at the active power lines, looking at the earth, looking at Mother, looking helpless.
"Do you think... should I call an ambulance?"
I think I heard him say that. And if he did, which surely he must have, Mother must have whispered a reply. Or maybe she wasn't able to whisper anything. I don't know. I've always imagined that she asked to be taken home. I was told later that the farmer whose tractor we'd hit rushed from his house. He'd called the police, which we knew would bring trouble because the car wasn't insured and none of us had been wearing seatbelts. It took perhaps 20 minutes after the farmer informed Utah Power of the accident for them to switch off the deadly current pulsing through the lines. Then Dad lifted Mother from the station wagon, and I saw her face. Her eyes, hidden under dark circles the size of plums, and the swelling distorting her soft features, stretching some, compressing others. I don't know how we got home or when, but I remember that the mountain face glowed orange in the morning light. Once inside, I watched Tyler spit streams of crimson down the bathroom sink. His front teeth had smashed into the steering wheel and been displaced, so that they jutted backward toward the roof of his mouth. Mother was laid on the sofa. She mumbled that the light hurt her eyes. We closed the blinds. She wanted to be in the basement, where there were no windows, so Dad carried her downstairs, and I didn't see her for several hours, not until that evening, when I used a dull flashlight to bring her dinner. When I saw her, I didn't know her. Both eyes were a deep purple, so deep they looked black, and so swollen I couldn't tell whether they were open or closed. She called me Audrey, even after I corrected her twice.
"Thank you, Audrey, but just dark and quiet, that's fine. Dark, quiet, thank you. Come check on me again, Audrey, in a little while."
Mother didn't come out of the basement for a week. Every day the swelling worsened, the black bruises turned blacker. Every night I was sure her face was as marked and deformed as it was possible for a face to be, but every morning it was somehow darker, more tumid. After a week, when the sun went down, we turned off the lights and Mother came upstairs. She looked as if she had two objects strapped to her forehead, large as apples, black as olives. There was never any more talk of a hospital. The moment for such a decision had passed, and to return to it would be to return to all the fury and fear of the accident itself. Dad said doctors couldn't do anything for her anyhow. She was in God's hands. In the coming months, Mother called me by many names. When she called me Audrey, I didn't worry. But it was troubling when we had conversations in which she referred to me as Luke or Tony, and in the family it had always been agreed, even by Mother herself, that she's never been quite the same since the accident. We kids called her Raccoon Eyes. We thought it was a great joke. Once the black rings had been around for a few weeks, long enough for us to get used to them and make them the subject of jokes. We had no idea it was a medical term. Raccoon Eyes. A sign of serious brain injury. Tyler's guilt was all-consuming. He blamed himself for the accident, then kept on blaming himself for every decision that was made thereafter, every repercussion, every reverberation that clanged down through the years. He laid claim to that moment and all its consequences, as if time itself had commenced the instant our station wagon left the road, and there was no history, no context, no agency of any kind until he began it, at the age of 17, by falling asleep at the wheel. Even now, when Mother forgets any detail, however trivial, that look comes into his eyes, the one he had in the moments after the collision, when blood poured from his own mouth as he took in the scene, raking his eyes over what he imagined to be the work of his hands and his hands only. Me? I never blamed anyone for the accident, least of all Tyler. It was just one of those things. A decade later, my understanding would shift, part of my heavy swing into adulthood, and after that, the accident would always make me think of the Apache women, and of all the decisions that go into making a life, the choices people make, together and on their own, that combine to produce any single event. Grains of sand, incalculable, pressing into sediment, then rock. Chapter 5. Honest Dirt. The mountain thawed, and the princess appeared on its face, her head brushing the sky. It was Sunday, a month after the accident, and everyone had gathered in the living room. Dad had begun to expound a scripture, when Tyler cleared his throat and said he was leaving.
I'm going to college,
he said, his face rigid. A vein in his neck bulged as he forced the words out, appearing and disappearing every few seconds, a great struggling snake. Everyone looked at Dad. His expression was folded, impassive. The silence was worse than shouting. Tyler would be the third of my brothers to leave home. My oldest brother, Tony, drove rigs, hauling gravel or scrap, trying to scrape together enough money to marry the girl down the road. Sean, the next oldest, had quarreled with Dad a few months before and taken off. I hadn't seen him since, though Mother got a hurried call every few weeks telling her he was fine, that he was welding or driving rigs. If Tyler left too, Dad wouldn't have a crew, and without a crew, he couldn't build barns or hay sheds. He would have to fall back on scrapping. "What's college?" I said.
"College is extra school for people too dumb to learn the first time around," Dad said.
Tyler stared at the floor, his face tense. Then his shoulders dropped, his face relaxed, and he looked up. It seemed to me that he'd stepped out of himself. His eyes were soft, pleasant. I couldn't see him in there at all. He listened to Dad, who settled into a lecture.
"There's two kinds of them college professors," Dad said. "Those who know they're lying, and those who think they're telling the truth."
Dad grinned.
"Don't know which is worse, come to think of it. A bona fide agent of the Illuminati, who at least knows he's on the devil's payroll, or a high-minded professor who thinks his wisdom is greater than God's."
He was still grinning. The situation wasn't serious. He just needed to talk some sense into his son. Mother said Dad was wasting his time, that nobody could talk Tyler out of anything once his mind was made up. "You may as well take a broom and start sweeping dirt off the mountain," she said. Then she stood, took a few moments to steady herself, and trudged downstairs. She had a migraine. She nearly always had a migraine. She was still spending her days in the basement, coming upstairs only after the sun had gone down, and even then she rarely stayed more than an hour before the combination of noise and exertion made her head throb. I watched her slow, careful progress down the steps, her back bent, both hands gripping the rail as if she were blind and had to feel her way. She waited for both feet to plant solidly on one step before reaching for the next. The swelling in her face was nearly gone, and she almost looked like herself again, except for the rings, which had gradually faded from black to dark purple and were now a mix of lilac and raisin. An hour later, Dad was no longer grinning. Tyler had not repeated his wish to go to college, but he had not promised to stay either. He was just sitting there, behind that vacant expression, writing it out.
"A man can't make a living out of books and scraps of paper," Dad said. "You're going to be the head of a family. How can you support a wife and children with books?"
Tyler tilted his head, showed he was listening, and said nothing.
"A son of mine, standing in line to get brainwashed by socialists and Illuminati spies. The school's run by the church,
Tyler interrupted.
"How bad can it be?"
Dad's mouth flew open, and a gust of air rushed out.
"You don't think the Illuminati have infiltrated the church?"
His voice was booming, every word reverberated with a powerful energy.
"You don't think the first place they'd go is that school, where they can raise up a whole generation of socialist Mormons? I raised you better than that!"
I will always remember my father in this moment, the potency of him, and the desperation. He leans forward, jaw set, eyes narrow, searching his son's face for some sign of agreement, some crease of shared conviction. He doesn't find it. The story of how Tyler decided to leave the mountain is a strange one, full of gaps and twists. It begins with Tyler himself, with the bizarre fact of him. It happens sometimes in families. One child who doesn't fit, whose rhythm is off, whose meter is set to the wrong tune. In our family, that was Tyler. He was waltzing while the rest of us hopped a jig. He was deaf to the raucous music of our lives, and we were deaf to the serene polyphony of his. Tyler liked books. He liked quiet. He liked organizing and arranging and labeling. Once, Mother found a whole shelf of matchboxes in his closet, stacked by year. Tyler said they contained his pencil shavings from the past 5 years, which he had collected to make fire starters for our Head for the Hills bags. The rest of the house was pure confusion. Piles of unwashed laundry, oily and black from the junkyard, littered the bedroom floors. In the kitchen, murky jars of tincture lined every table and cabinet, and these were only cleared away to make space for even messier projects, perhaps to skin a deer carcass or strip cosmoline off a rifle. But in the heart of this chaos, Tyler had half a decade's pencil shavings, cataloged by year. My brothers were like a pack of wolves. They tested each other constantly, with scuffles breaking out every time some young pup hit a growth spurt and dreamed of moving up. When I was young, these tussles usually ended with mother screaming over a broken lamp or vase. But as I got older, there were fewer things left to break. Mother said we'd owned a TV once, when I was a baby, until Sean had put Tyler's head through it. While his brothers wrestled, Tyler listened to music. He owned the only boombox I had ever seen, and next to it, he kept a tall stack of CDs with strange words on them like Mozart and Chopin. One Sunday afternoon, when he was perhaps 16, he caught me looking at them. I tried to run because I thought he might wallop me for being in his room, but instead, he took my hand and led me to the stack.
Which one do you like best? He said.
One was black, with 100 men and women dressed in white on the cover. I pointed to it. Tyler eyed me skeptically.
This is choir music, he said.
He slipped the disc into the black box, then sat at his desk to read. I squatted on the floor by his feet, scratching designs into the carpet. The music began, a breath of strings, then a whisper of voices, chanting, soft as silk, but somehow piercing. The hymn was familiar to me. We'd sung it at church, a chorus of mismatched voices raised in worship, but this was different. It was worshipful, but it was also something else, something to do with study, discipline, and collaboration, something I didn't yet understand. The song ended, and I sat paralyzed as the next played, and the next, until the CD finished. The room felt lifeless without the music. I asked Tyler if we could listen to it again, and an hour later, when the music stopped, I begged him to restart it. It was very late, and the house quiet, when Tyler stood from his desk and pushed play, saying this was the last time.
We can listen again tomorrow, he said.
Music became our language. Tyler's speech impediment kept him quiet, made his tongue heavy. Because of that, he and I never talked much. I had not known my brother. Now, every evening when he came in from the junkyard, I would be waiting for him. After he'd showered, scrubbing the day's grime from his skin, he'd settle in at his desk and say,
What shall we listen to tonight?
Then I would choose a CD, and he would read while I lay on the floor next to his feet, eyes fixed on his socks, and listened. I was as rowdy as any of my brothers, but when I was with Tyler, I transformed. Maybe it was the music, the grace of it, or maybe it was his grace. Somehow he made me see myself through his eyes. I tried to remember not to shout. I tried to avoid fights with Richard, especially the kind that ended with the two of us rolling on the floor, him pulling my hair, me dragging my fingernails through the softness of his face. I should have known that one day Tyler would leave. Tony and Sean had gone, and they'd belonged on the mountain in a way that Tyler never did. Tyler had always loved what Dad called book learning, which was something the rest of us, with the exception of Richard, were perfectly indifferent to. There had been a time, when Tyler was a boy, when Mother had been idealistic about education. She used to say that we were kept at home so we could get a better education than other kids. But it was only Mother who said that, as Dad thought we should learn more practical skills. When I was very young, that was the battle between them. Mother trying to hold school every morning, and Dad herding the boys into the junkyard the moment her back was turned. But Mother would lose that battle eventually. It began with Luke, the fourth of her five sons. Luke was smart when it came to the mountain. He worked with animals in a way that made it seem like he was talking to them, but he had a severe learning disability and struggled to learn to read. Mother spent 5 years sitting with him at the kitchen table every morning, explaining the same sounds again and again. But by the time he was 12, it was all Luke could do to cough out a sentence from the Bible during family scripture study. Mother couldn't understand it. She'd had no trouble teaching Tony and Sean to read, and everyone else had just sort of picked it up. Tony had taught me to read when I was 4, to win a bet with Sean, I think. Once Luke could scratch out his name and read short, simple phrases, Mother turned to math. What math I was ever taught, I learned doing the breakfast dishes and listening to Mother explain over and over what a fraction is or how to use negative numbers. Luke never made any progress, and after a year, Mother gave up. She stopped talking about us getting a better education than other kids. She began to echo Dad. "All that really matters," she said to me one morning, "is that you kids learn to read. That other twaddle is just brainwashing." Dad started coming in earlier and earlier to round up the boys until, by the time I was 8 and Tyler 16, we'd settled into a routine that omitted school altogether. Mother's conversion to Dad's philosophy was not total, however, and occasionally she was possessed of her old enthusiasm. On those days, when the family was gathered around the table eating breakfast, Mother would announce that today we were doing school. She kept a bookshelf in the basement, stocked with books on herbalism, along with a few old paperbacks. There were a few textbooks on math, which we shared, and an American history book that I never saw anyone read except Richard. There was also a science book, which must have been for young children, because it was filled with glossy illustrations. It usually took half an hour to find all the books. Then we would divide them up and go into separate rooms to do school. I have no idea what my siblings did when they did school, but when I did it, I opened my math book and spent 10 minutes turning pages, running my fingers down the center fold. If my finger touched 50 pages, I'd report to Mother that I'd done 50 pages of math.
"Amazing," she'd say. "You see, that pace would never be possible in the public school. You can only do that at home, where you can sit down and really focus, with no distractions."
Mother never delivered lectures or administered exams. She never assigned essays. There was a computer in the basement with a program called Mavis Beacon, which gave lessons on typing. Sometimes, when she was delivering herbs, if we'd finished our chores, Mother would drop us at the Carnegie Library in the center of town. The basement had a room full of children's books, which we read. Richard even took books from upstairs, books for adults, with heavy titles about history and science. Learning in our family was entirely self-directed. You could learn anything you could teach yourself, after your work was done. Some of us were more disciplined than others. I was one of the least disciplined, so by the time I was 10, the only subject I had studied systematically was Morse code, because Dad insisted that I learn it.
"If the lines are cut, we'll be the only people in the valley who can communicate," he said,
though I was never quite sure, if we were the only people learning it, who we'd be communicating with. The older boys, Tony, Sean, and Tyler, had been raised in a different decade, and it was almost as if they'd had different parents. Their father had never heard of the Weavers. He never talked about the Illuminati. He'd enrolled his 3 oldest sons in school, and even though he'd pulled them out a few years later, vowing to teach them at home, when Tony had asked to go back, Dad had let him. Tony had stayed in school through high school, although he missed so many days working in the junkyard that he wasn't able to graduate. Because Tyler was the 3rd son, he barely remembered school and was happy to study at home. Until he turned 13. Then, perhaps because Mother was spending all her time teaching Luke to read, Tyler asked Dad if he could enroll in the 8th grade. Tyler stayed in school that whole year, from the fall of 1991 through the spring of 1992. He learned algebra, which felt as natural to his mind as air to his lungs. Then the Weavers came under siege that August. I don't know if Tyler would have gone back to school, but I know that after Dad heard about the Weavers, he never again allowed one of his children to set foot in a public classroom. Still, Tyler's imagination had been captured. With what money he had, he bought an old trigonometry textbook and continued to study on his own. He wanted to learn calculus next, but couldn't afford another book, so he went to the school and asked the math teacher for one. The teacher laughed in his face. "You can't teach yourself calculus," he said. "It's impossible." Tyler pushed back. "Give me a book. I think I can." He left with the book tucked under his arm. The real challenge was finding time to study. Every morning at 7, my father gathered his sons, divided them into teams, and sent them out to tackle the tasks of the day. It usually took about an hour for Dad to notice that Tyler was not among his brothers. Then he'd burst through the back door and stride into the house to where Tyler sat studying in his room.
"What the hell are you doing?"
he'd shout, tracking clumps of dirt onto Tyler's spotless carpet.
"I've got Luke loading I-beams by himself, one man doing a two-man job, and I come in here and find you sitting on your ass?"
If Dad had caught me with a book when I was supposed to be working, I'd have skittered, but Tyler was steady.
"Dad," he'd say, "I'll work after lunch, but I need the morning to study.
Most mornings, they'd argue for a few minutes, then Tyler would surrender his pencil, his shoulders slumping as he pulled on his boots and welding gloves. But there were other mornings, mornings that always astonished me, when Dad huffed out the back door, alone. I didn't believe Tyler would really go to college, that he would ever abandon the mountain to join the Illuminati. I figured Dad had all summer to bring Tyler to his senses, which he tried to do most days when the crew came in for lunch. The boys would putter around the kitchen, dishing up seconds and thirds, and Dad would stretch himself out on the hard linoleum because he was tired and needed to lie down but was too dirty for Mother's sofa, and begin his lecture about the Illuminati. One lunch in particular has lodged in my memory. Tyler is assembling tacos from the fixings Mother has laid out. He lines up the shells on his plate, three in a perfect row, then adds the hamburger, lettuce, and tomatoes carefully, measuring the amounts, perfectly distributing the sour cream. Dad drones steadily. Then, just as Dad reaches the end of his lecture and takes a breath to begin again, Tyler slides all three of the flawless tacos into Mother's juicer, the one she uses to make tinctures, and turns it on. A loud roar howls through the kitchen, imposing a kind of silence. The roar ceases. Dad resumes. Tyler pours the orange liquid into a glass and begins to drink, carefully, delicately, because his front teeth are still loose, still trying to jump out of his mouth. Many memories might be summoned to symbolize this period of our lives, but this is the one that has stayed with me, of Dad's voice rising up from the floor while Tyler drinks his tacos. As spring turned to summer, Dad's resolve turned to denial. He acted as if the argument were over and he had won. He stopped talking about Tyler's leaving and refused to hire a hand to replace him. One warm afternoon, Tyler took me to visit Grandma and Grandpa over in town, who lived in the same house where they'd raised Mother, a house that could not have been more different from ours. The decor was not expensive, but it was well cared for. Creamy white carpet on the floors, soft floral paper on the walls, thick, pleated curtains in the windows. They seldom replaced anything. The carpet, the wallpaper, the kitchen table, and countertops, everything was the same as it was in the slides I'd seen of my mother's childhood. Dad didn't like us spending time there. Before he retired, Grandpa had been a mailman, and Dad said no one worth our respect would have worked for the government. Grandma was even worse, Dad said. She was frivolous. I didn't know what that word meant, but he said it so often that I'd come to associate it with her creamy carpet and soft petal wallpaper. Tyler loved it there. He loved the calm, the order, the soft way my grandparents spoke to each other. There was an aura in that house that made me feel instinctively, without ever being told, that I was not to shout, not to hit anyone or tear through the kitchen at full speed. I did have to be told, and told repeatedly, to leave my muddy shoes by the door. Off to college, Grandma said once we were settled onto the floral print sofa. She turned to me. You must be so proud of your brother. Her eyes squinted to accommodate her smile. I could see every one of her teeth. Leave it to Grandma to think getting yourself brainwashed is something to celebrate, I thought. I need the bathroom, I said. Alone in the hall, I walked slowly, pausing with each step to let my toes sink into the carpet. I smiled, remembering that Dad had said Grandma could keep her carpet so white only because Grandpa had never done any real work.
My hands might be dirty, Dad had said, winking at me and displaying his blackened fingernails. But it's honest dirt.
Weeks passed, and it was full summer. One Sunday, Dad called the family together.
We've got a good supply of food, he said. We've got fuel and water stored away. What we don't got is money.
Dad took a 20 from his wallet and crumpled it.
Not this fake money. In the days of abomination, this won't be worth a thing. People will trade $100 bills for a roll of toilet paper.
I imagined a world where green bills littered the highway like empty soda cans. I looked around. Everyone else seemed to be imagining that too, especially Tyler. His eyes were focused, determined.
I've got a little money saved, Dad said, and your mother's got some tucked away. We're going to change it into silver. That's what people will be wishing they had soon, silver and gold.
A few days later, Dad came home with the silver and even some gold. The metal was in the form of coins, packed in small, heavy boxes, which he carried through the house and piled in the basement. He wouldn't let me open them.
They aren't for playing, he said.
Sometime after, Tyler took several $1,000, nearly all the savings he had left after he'd paid the farmer for the tractor and Dad for the station wagon, and bought his own pile of silver, which he stacked in the basement next to the gun cabinet. He stood there for a long time, considering the boxes, as if suspended between two worlds. Tyler was a softer target. I begged, and he gave me a silver coin as big as my palm. The coin soothed me. It seemed to me that Tyler's buying it was a declaration of loyalty, a pledge to our family that despite the madness that had hold of him, that made him want to go to school, ultimately he would choose us, fight on our side when the end came. By the time the leaves began to change, from the juniper greens of summer to the garnet reds and bronzed golds of autumn, that coin shimmered even in the lowest light, polished by 1,000 finger strokes. I'd taken comfort in the raw physicality of it, certain that if the coin was real, Tyler's leaving could not be. I awoke one morning in August to find Tyler packing his clothes, books, and CDs into boxes. He'd nearly finished by the time we sat down to breakfast. I ate quickly, then went into his room and looked at his shelves, now empty except for a single CD, the black one, with the image of the people dressed in white, which I now recognized as the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Tyler appeared in the doorway.
I'm leaving that for you, he said.
Then he walked outside and hosed down his car, blasting away the Idaho dust until it looked as though it had never seen a dirt road. Dad finished his breakfast and left without a word. I understood why. The sight of Tyler loading boxes into his car made me crazed. I wanted to scream, but instead I ran, out the back door and up through the hills toward the peak. I ran until the sound of blood pulsing in my ears was louder than the thoughts in my head. Then I turned around and ran back, swinging around the pasture to the red railroad car. I scrambled onto its roof just in time to see Tyler close his trunk and turn in a circle, as if he wanted to say goodbye, but there was no one to say goodbye to. I imagined him calling my name and pictured his face falling when I didn't answer. He was in the driver's seat by the time I'd climbed down, and the car was rumbling toward the dirt road when I leapt out from behind an iron tank. Tyler stopped, then got out, and hugged me. Not the crouching hug that adults often give children, but the other kind, both of us standing, him pulling me into him and bringing his face close to mine. He said he would miss me, then he let me go, stepping into his car and speeding down the hill and onto the highway. I watched the dust settle. Tyler rarely came home after that. He was building a new life for himself across enemy lines. He made few excursions back